272, Part 4, Chapters 9 through 12. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 272, Dressage. Anyone? This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. And SeedPod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative. We publish books, not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Happy Hands Hand Cream, the non-greasy hand cream for people who can't afford a slippery grip. Visit happyhandsstore.com for more information. Oh, hello there. There is so much to do, so much to see, so much to talk about. I have so many things to share with you. So first, I'm going to share a contest that you guys are kind of primed for. So really, I think it's just kind of in the box. One of you is going to do this, so let me play you some audio with Katie over at Yarn Love.
The contest is really simple. I am just looking for literary inspired colors. So if your listeners have a favorite heroine, could be a literary person, could be a historical person, that they could choose a color that matches that person, describe it to me, post pictures of the exact color that they want it to be, should they choose to. And if they win the contest, that color becomes a part of our regular line. They also will receive skeins of their created color so that they can play with it and have fun.
Yay! So can they, should they be posting these things on Pinterest, on Flickr, on Twitter? How do they get their information to you?
Right now, we are running it as a simple post via our Ravelry forum. So if they want to post a picture, it's all integrated into the forums. And I think most of your listeners will probably be familiar with Ravelry. Yeah. That way they can post the picture and just a little blurb of the description for me. And you can get as elaborate or as simple as you want. If your post is really clever, I give bonus points for that. So, you know, make it good, make it entertaining. It doesn't have to be serious. I'm looking for this to be fun, a fun thing.
Very cool. So I'm assuming that part of the decision making in who wins is going to be who gets both a good literary character or historical character and color combo, but also one that isn't already taken by somebody else that you've secretly done.
Yes, yes. And right now, because I'm about to release 14 other colors, those colors have very normal names. They're things like blood orange and Spanish heather and things like this. So for this contest, it should be very easy for them to create a name that isn't already taken. Great. If they're looking for more information, I do have several of my favorite characters and historical people who are already in my yarn line, and they can follow the links in the Ravelry thread and just take a look at what I already have so they're not double dipping.
Cool. And is it just Yarn Love? What's your
Ravelry group? My Ravelry group is Yarn Love. Okay. So if you just go search for Yarn Love, we should come right up.
Fantastic. That's so exciting. This is going to be so much fun. I know you're going to get people.
I hope so. It sounded like something that I would want to do. And I know. So I hope people have fun with it. So go nuts.
I think they will. 'Tis the season, after all, yes, to go a little nuts, especially when you think about like draping yourself in color as a literary or historical character.
Hysterical, yes. Yes.
There's a few of those too. And there are links from your Ravelry group to your Etsy store.
Yes.
Yep. So people will be able to get to you.
Yep. If they go to my Ravelry group, they can get to my regular site, which has all of the information and all of the colorways and the Etsy shop and all my retailers. So it's sort of one-stop shopping links from there.
So there it is. Oh, please go and participate. I really want one of our Craftlit people to win. And then you have to write and you have to tell me all about it so that I can tell everybody else. Speaking of, for those who are subscriber supporters, I got a very interesting post on Ravelry in the Wuthering Heights thread about Kathy. And the post was from someone who actually knows what they're talking about, a licensed clinical social worker. And that is going to be part of the Wuthering Heights chit chat on this week's Wuthering Heights episode. So I hope some of you choose to do this. Go out, invent a name for a yarn and a color, and go to Katie's Rev Place on Ravelry. You can get there directly from the craftlit.com show notes for episode 272. I have posted those for you. And go win some yarn. Go have some fun. And if that wasn't enough for you, I even have more ways to win yarn this week. Jamie has sent me some information that next Friday is I Love Yarn Day. And what is going on with I Love Yarn Day? It is this. It is a Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram photo contest. Your job, should you choose to accept it, is to upload pictures that depict your passion for yarn. If you use entries, if you enter via Twitter and Instagram, just make sure to use the hashtag yarn day contest, all one word, as part of the caption. Now, I have a link from the show notes for you to get more information, but why, I hear you say to me, why would I go ahead and upload photos about how much I love yarn? Well, because the winner of the contest, whoever uploads the best photo, will win 365 skeins that are being donated by Bernat, Pattons, Karen, Lion Brand Yarn, and Red Heart. The 10 photos that received the most votes on Facebook, because Facebook is kind of the hub around which all of this is happening, those runners-up will win tote bags, I Love Yarn Day tote bags, that include, get this, a copy of Knit and Style, Knit 123, and Crochet 123, plus a free subscription to the magazine of your choice, a copy of Creative Knitting Magazine and Crochet Magazine, Knit and Crochet Accessories from Boy, Clover Needle Craft Knit Mate Accessory Kit and 29-inch Circular Knitting Needles, Creative Partners Knit and Crochet Book by Jean Lienhauser and Rita Weiss, a copy of Crochet Today magazine, from Interweave, a copy of Interweave Knits, Interweave Crochet, Knit Scene magazines, plus Knitting Daily TV series 900 DVDs. Leisure Arts will send a Knook, Knook, K-N-O-O-K, beginner kit. Soho Publishing will send a Vogue Knitting Anniversary issue, Knit Simple, W Bliss magazine, Noro magazine, plus a set of Knit Notes, books for recording your projects. And TMA will be sending a dozen skeins of yarn for each of the runners-up. The deadline for submissions is 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on October 15th. So that's 3 days after the official I Love Yarn Day on the 12th. Voting will be open to the public until 11:59 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on October 22nd. Alrighty, so number one, lots of things will be happening on I Love Yarn Day, October 12th. So get out. AC Moore and Crafts, Michaels, Joann's, all these craft stores are going to be participating in this day. Take your yarn to work. Yarn bomb your friends. Teach somebody else how to crochet or knit. Wrap yourself in yarn and love, love, love it. You can also visit www.iloveyarnday.com. all one word, .org. And from there, you can get to the Facebook, Pinterest, Twitter, and all sorts of information on how you can participate in I Love Yarn Day. Sounds like fun. Me? I'll be sitting here working for you. Well, if you subscribe over at Mama O Knits, you saw that last week I was making lots of little zombies for my boys and their friends. And this week, Now that the zombies were done, I needed some kind of fun, not particularly taxing knitting to do. I've been designing stuff, and so I needed kind of a palette cleansing break, as it were. And so I'm knitting a beard. It came through on a KnitPix email this morning, and I just couldn't stop giggling. And so I am knitting my boys' beards. Incognito beards that they can take over to their friends this weekend. So it's a really cute pattern. It's adorable. And it's available at KnitPix for $1.99. And it's posted on my Ravelry feed. And I will be posting something about it on Mama O Knits as soon as I can get there. Today, I think it's time to dive into Gulliver. And that means, as always, with the end of satire, that it's going to be a wee bit of a downer. And you know, with people like Swift and like Twain, you can really tell, and sometimes you can even see it with Jon Stewart, that a lot of the satire comes from the pain of having been such a wide open idealist at some point. And instead of going into just pure cynicism by the way that the world has failed them, and I don't mean that in a petulant way, but I mean failed to live up to their ideals and failed to live up to the promise of what it could be. Instead of just going into pure cynicism, something in them propels them into satire. So at least they can laugh about it, even if it's a dry, wry, pitiless laugh. Today, the laughs are going to be few and far between. I will tell you that right now. And in fact, the laughs that you do manage to pull out of these last few chapters are more along the lines of the kind rather than the ha 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 ha. So I am going to break in between a couple of the chapters because there's some fairly complicated satire that happens towards the end of the book. And it's a long way between here and there. And I didn't want to get you thinking about the stuff that happens at the end before we deal with the stuff that happens at the beginning of today's chapters. However, there is one thing I needed to correct, is RSS feeds doesn't just stand for really simple syndication. Evidently, it also stands for rich site summary, or even originally stood for rich site summary. And I thought you should know. So we know the end is coming. We know that Gulliver cannot stay with the Weenums forever. And this is where Swift is forced to, you know, just by the fact that he's a good storyteller, he's kind of forced himself into this position where he is going to have the Weenums deal with Gulliver. He is a Yahoo, as far as they're concerned, a Yahoo who seems to have some semblance of reason to him, but nonetheless, he is a Yahoo. And his presence there, it's caused buzz, and it will continue to cause a buzz, and that isn't something that the Houyhnhnms are going to be able to deal with very well. You know, they don't really have any room in their world for any kind of sensation, and by sensation, I mean like sensationalism, that kind of Princess Diana sensation, making a sensation. And that puts Gulliver in a very tenuous position as far as living among the horses goes. But we've also seen something very different happening in this portion of the book. In parts 1, 2, and 3, we went into these strange places looking through the eyes of Gulliver. We traveled with him. We were there in Lilliput. We were there in Brobdingnag. And now that we're here with the Houyhnhnms, this land of pure reason, we are feeling a distance from Gulliver. And that is because it is impossible for Swift to place us in the position of someone who is trying to be a purely rational creature. I'm sorry, of a human who is trying to be a purely rational creature. It isn't possible. Everybody thinks they're rational. Everybody thinks they have common sense. Everybody thinks they are making wise, just, and fair decisions. That's our human nature. And of course, we know we are the only ones who are really doing all those things. Everybody else is dangerous and crazy, but we're good and safe. Well, there was no way for Swift to pull off having us take this particular journey with Gulliver. He had to distance us from him. And he's been gradually pulling us away since Gulliver landed in Houyhnhnm land. He's been gradually pulling us away, distancing us further and further from Gulliver on an emotional level so that we start to see him for the Yahoo he is. It's kind of like the little monkey who's on that TV show right now, Animal Practice. I haven't watched it. I love the guy who's the lead. I saw him years ago on stage in Love, Valor, Compassion, and wow, Justin Kirk, I think. He's an amazing actor, and I'm glad he's working, but I think he's a much better actor than what is being demanded of him right now with a monkey on his shoulder. And trust me, I am a friend of the Capuchin monkey. I have a picture that I love very much of me at Disney working on the film Aladdin with the Capuchin monkey, who was the body model for Abu. And the monkey is on my shoulder, and they posted the picture that said Heather with the Disney monkey on her back. And I love this picture, so I'm not dissing the monkey, is what I'm saying. But dressing a monkey up in a lab coat and calling it a doctor is not all that different from Gulliver trying to be, hoping someday to be able to call himself a Houyhnhnm. There's the physical part to begin with. It doesn't matter how much you try, you really can't prance like a horse if you only have two legs. You can do a fair imitation, I'm sure, but it's not going to carry that same gravitas that you get with a horse. And then you also have the additional problem of just bloody well being human. We are messy, as we said last week. And Gulliver, in trying so hard to distance himself from the Yahoos, this week you will hear just how far he goes. And Swift being Swift, he will pull no punches. He will tell you things that Gulliver has done that will turn your stomach, if you're paying attention. And it's supposed to. It's supposed to. It's supposed to be the beginning of the realization that the rug is being pulled out from under you, that Swift has made fun of absolutely every other kind of human. They are all selfish, small-minded, stupid, wasted, illegitimate, illiterate, amoral, anti-intellectual, humorless, thuggish prigs. Or they're Houyhnhnms. And the Houyhnhnms have their own problems. And one of those problems is their inhumanity. They aren't human. And I keep having this thing happen to me when I'm reading these last parts of the book, what I think of as my Captain Kirk moments, where you know how at the end of the old Star Trek, James T. Kirk, they come into contact with some alien race, some alien civilization. They have boldly gone somewhere. And the interaction between the flawed but well-meaning humans and whatever the alien group is. I'm especially reminded of this in the Menagerie, the two-parter that had originally been the pilot, but it was flawed. And then they superimposed Captain Kirk and Spock and everybody Spock was in the original one, but they superimposed Kirk and his kind of ethos onto the Menagerie, made a long two-parter. And so part of the commentary there is on what it means to be human and what humanity means, that there is a level of compassion to us that you don't necessarily see in the animal world. And yet, it is almost like Jonathan Swift is seeing the future and seeing the romantics coming. and their love of nature and the heightened, the elevation of all things natural to this pinnacle that we all can strive for, to be as beautiful as nature, to be as tempestuous as nature, to be whatever Percy, Keats, and Shelley would want you to be. And it's almost like Swift is going, yeah, well, look, people stink. They constantly stink. They are always doing horrible things to each other. Small-minded, petulant little children is what adults are. But you can't look at nature for a role model either, because this is what you get. And he hands you the Houyhnhnm, who look really good at the beginning. And then the longer you're with them, they don't love each other. They can interchange their children. It's a bloodless, passionless existence. They have a very narrow language. Their poetry is correct. It isn't beautiful. And this is very hard for us. And I think it was also hard for Swift. I don't think he had an easy time writing this section. I think he knew he had to, but I don't think he enjoyed it. There's no raucous joy of ripping into the Whigs in this section. And it's also that kind of thing. I keep having these flashes of Twain. Somewhere I read Twain, it could have been Letters from the Earth, Twain talking about heaven and how boring heaven would be, and that he'd rather be in hell because it was bound to be more interesting. I kind of can't get away from this image of the Houyhnhnms being that kind of heaven. And maybe it's just something to do with satirists and how they might describe a state of blissful perfection, and that it's just so god-awful boring. But the Houyhnhnms are definitely peaceful. They are kind, if that is the rational thing to be, and that's all great. But correct me if I'm wrong, some of the stuff in these chapters has been kind of dull, kind of quiet, especially after Lilliput and Brobdingnag, and then, you know, the crazy flying island and the people with the bladders getting whacked on the side of their head to get them to pay attention. I mean, all that ridiculousness, and then suddenly silence, and this rational state takes over. And at first it's a relief, and then it's kind of creepy. So in the first chapter for today, chapter 9, you're going to hear really your last descriptive section on the Houyhnhnms and how they work their society. And this includes things like poetry and death and politics in the kind of minimalist way that they have to deal with politics, because of course, them being all rational, they all see the same things the same way and come to the same conclusions, because that's the reasoned answer. There would only be one answer in their world. Chapter 10 begins the final conflict. And there's only one word in here that's used archaically that I think might throw you, and he's used it before, artificially. Doesn't mean what we think it means in this context. It means artfully. So something that he fastens very well instead of in a fake way. But this is the section where you will hear Gulliver has gone as far from Yahoo life, as far from being human as he possibly can. And you'll find what that does to him and the Houyhnhnms among who he is living. So we're going to listen to 9 and 10 first, and then I'm going to break in and tell you a couple more things to head you into the last couple of chapters. So here we go with Gulliver's Travels, Part 4, Chapters 9 and 10.
Chapter 9, A Grand Debate at the General Assembly of the Houyhnhnms, and how it was determined, the learning of the Houyhnhnms, their buildings, the manner of burials, the defectiveness of their language. One of these grand assemblies was held in my time about 3 months before my departure, whither my master went as the representative of our district. In this council was resumed their old debate, and indeed the only debate that ever happened in their country, whereof my master, after his return, gave me a very particular account. The question to be debated was whether the Yahoos should be exterminated from the face of the earth. One of the members of the affirmative offered several arguments of great strength and weight, alleging that as the Yahoos were the most filthy, noisome, and deformed animal which nature ever produced, so they were the most restive and indocible, mischievous and malicious. They would privately suck the teats of the Hooenum's cows, kill and devour their cats, trample down their oats and grass if they were not continually watched, and commit 1,000 other extravagancies. He took notice of a general tradition that Yahoos had not been always in their country, but that many ages ago, two of these brutes appeared together upon a mountain, whether produced by the heat of the sun upon corrupted mud and slime, or from the ooze and froth of the sea was never known, that these Yahoos engendered and their brood in a short time grew so numerous as to overrun and infest the whole nation. That the Hooenums, to get rid of this evil, made a general hunting, and at last enclosed the whole herd, and destroying the older, every Hooenum kept two young ones in a kennel, and brought them to such a degree of tameness as an animal so savage by nature can be capable of acquiring, using them for draught and carriage. That there seemed to be much truth in this tradition, and that those creatures could not be Ilanhamyimshi, or aborigines of the land, because of the violent hatred the Hooenums, as well as all other animals, bore them, which, although their evil disposition sufficiently deserved, could never have arrived at so high a degree if they had been aborigines, or else they would have long since been rooted out. That the inhabitants, taking a fancy to use the service of the Yahoos, had very imprudently neglected to cultivate the breed of asses, which were a comely animal, easily kept, more tame and orderly, without any offensive smell, strong enough for labor, although they yield to the other in agility of body. And if their braying be no agreeable sound, it is far preferable to the horrible howlings of the Yahoos. Several others declared their sentiments to the same purpose, when my master proposed an expedient to the assembly, whereof he had indeed borrowed the hint from me. He approved of the tradition mentioned by the honorable member who spoke before, and affirmed that the two Yahoos said to be first seen among them had been driven thither over the sea, that coming to land and being forsaken by their companions, they retired to the mountains, and degenerating by degrees, became in process of time much more savage than those of their own species in the country from whence those two originals came. The reason of his assertion was that he had now in his possession a certain wonderful Yahoo, meaning myself, which most of them had heard of and many of them had seen. He then related to them how he first found me, that my body was all covered with an artificial composure of the skins and hairs of other animals, that I spoke in a language of my own and had thoroughly learned theirs, that I had related to him the accidents which brought me hither, that when he saw me without my covering, I was an exact Yahoo in every part, only of a whiter color, less hairy, and with shorter claws. He added how I had endeavored to persuade him that in my own and other countries the Yahoos acted as the governing rational animal and held the Hooenum in servitude, that he observed in me all the qualities of a Yahoo, only a little more civilized by some tincture of reason, which, however, was in a degree as far inferior to the Hooenum race as the Yahoos of their country were to me, that among other things, I mentioned a custom we had of castrating Hooenums when they were young in order to render them tame, that the operation was easy and safe, that it was no shame to learn wisdom from brutes as industry is taught by the ant and building by the swallow, for so I translate the word lahan, although it be a much larger fowl, that this invention might be practiced upon the younger Yahoos here, which, besides rendering them tractable and fitter for use, would in an age put an end to the whole species without destroying life, that in the meantime the Hooenums should be exhorted to cultivate the breed of asses, which, as they are in all respects more valuable brutes, so they have this advantage, to be fit for service at 5 years old, which the others are not till 12. This was all my master thought fit to tell me at that time of what passed in the Grand Council, but he was pleased to conceal one particular, which related personally to myself, whereof I soon felt the unhappy effect, as the reader will know in its proper place, and from whence I date all the succeeding misfortunes of my life. The Hoenums have no letters, and consequently their knowledge is all traditional. But there happening few events of any moment among a people so well united, naturally disposed to every virtue, wholly governed by reason, and cut off from all commerce with other nations, the historical part is easily preserved without burdening their memories. I have already observed that they are subject to no diseases, and therefore can have no need of physicians. However, they have excellent medicines composed of herbs to cut accidental bruises and cuts in the pastern or frog of the foot by sharp stones, as well as other maims and hurts in several parts of the body. They calculate the year by the revolution of the sun and the moon, but use no subdivisions into weeks. They are well enough acquainted with the motions of those two luminaries, and understand the nature of eclipses, and this is the utmost progress of their astronomy. In poetry, they must be allowed to excel all other mortals, wherein the justness of their similes and the minuets, as well as exactness of their descriptions, are indeed inimitable. Their verses abound very much in both of these, and usually contain either some exalted notions of friendship and benevolence, or the praise of those who were victors in races and other bodily exercises. Their buildings, although very rude and simple, are not inconvenient, but well contrived to defend them from all injuries of cold and heat. They have a kind of tree, which at 40 years old loosens in the roots and falls with the first storm. It grows very straight, and being pointed like stakes with a sharp stone, for the Hoenums know not the use of iron, they stick them erect in the ground about 10 inches asunder, and then weave in oat straw, or sometimes wattles, betwixt them. The roof is made after the same manner, and so are the doors. The Hoenum use the hollow part between the pastern and the hoof of their forefoot, as we do our hands, and this with greater dexterity than I could at first imagine. I have seen a white mare of our family thread a needle, which I lent her on purpose, with that joint. They milk their cows, reap their oats, and do all the work which requires hands in the same manner. They have a kind of hard flints, which by grinding against other stones, they form into instruments that serve instead of wedges, axes, and hammers. With tools made of these flints, they likewise cut their hair and reap their oats, which there groweth naturally in several fields. The Yahoos draw home the sheaves and carriages, and the servants tread them in certain covered huts to get out the grain, which is kept in stores. They make a rude kind of earthen and wooden vessels, and bake the former in the sun. If they can avoid casualties, they die only of old age, and are buried in the obscurest places that can be found, their friends and relations expressing neither joy nor grief at their departure, nor does the dying person discover the least regret that he is leaving the world, any more than if he were upon returning home from a visit to one of his neighbors. I remember my master having once made an appointment with a friend and his family to come to his house upon some affair of importance. On the day fixed, the mistress and her two children came very late. She made two excuses. First, for her husband, who, as she said, happened that very morning to one. The word is strongly expressive in their language, but not easily rendered into English. It signifies to retire to his first mother. Her excuse for not coming sooner was that her husband dying late in the morning, she was a good while consulting her servants about a convenient place where his body should be laid, and I observed she behaved herself at our house as cheerfully as the rest. She died about 3 months after. They live generally to 70 or 75 years, very seldom 80. Some weeks before their death, they feel a gradual decay, but without pain. During this time, they are much visited by their friends, because they cannot go abroad with their usual ease and satisfaction. However, about 10 days before their death, which they seldom fail in computing, they return the visits that have been made them by those who are nearest in their neighborhood, being carried in a convenient sledge drawn by Yahoos, which vehicle they use not only upon this occasion, but when they grow old, upon long journeys, or when they are lame by an accident. And therefore, when the dying Hoenum return those visits, they take a solemn leave of their friends, as if they were going to some remote part of the country where they design to pass the rest of their lives. I know not whether it may be worth observing that the Hohenem have no word in their language to express anything that is evil, except what they borrow from the deformities or ill qualities of the Yahoos. Thus, they denote the folly of a servant, an omission of a child, a stone that cuts their feet, a continuance of foul or unseasonable weather, and the like, by adding to each the epithet of Yahoo. For instance, Hinnom Yahoo, Wenol Homan Yahoo, Yelen Hummawahalum Yahoo, and an ill-contrived house, Hilal Hum Haram Rahulm Yahoo. I could with great pleasure enlarge farther upon the manners and virtues of this excellent people, but intending in a short time to publish a volume by itself expressly upon that subject, I refer the reader thither. In the meantime, proceed to relate my own sad catastrophe. Chapter 10. The Author's Economy and Happy Life Among the Hohenems, His Great Improvements in Virtue by Conversing with Them. Their Conversations. The author hath notice given him by his master that he must depart from the country. He falls into a swoon for grief, but submits. He contrives and finishes a canoe by the help of a fellow servant, and puts to sea at a venture. I had settled my little economy to my own heart's content. My master had ordered a room to be made for me after their manner, about 6 yards from the house, the sides and floor of which I plastered with clay and covered with rush mats of my own contrivance. I had beaten hemp, which there grows wild, and made of it a sort of ticking. This I filled with the feathers of several birds I had taken with springes made of Yahoo's hairs, and were excellent food. I had worked 2 chairs with my knife, the sorrel nag helping me in the grosser and more laborious parts. When my clothes were worn to rags, I made myself others with the skins of rabbits and of a certain beautiful animal about the same size called Nun-Nun-No, the skin of which is covered with a fine down. Of these I likewise made very tolerable stockings. I sold my shoes with wood, which I cut from a tree and fitted to the upper leather, and when this was worn out, I supplied it with the skins of Yahoos dried in the sun. I often got honey out of hollow trees, which I mingled with water or ate with my bread. No man could more verify the truth of these 2 maxims, that nature is very easily satisfied, and that necessity is the mother of invention. I enjoyed perfect health of body and tranquility of mind. I did not feel the treachery or inconsistency of a friend, nor the injuries of a secret or open enemy. I had no occasion of bribing, flattering, or pimping to procure the favors of any great man or his minion. I wanted no fence against fraud or oppression. Here was neither physician to destroy my body, nor lawyer to ruin my fortune, no informer to watch my words and actions, or forge accusations against me for hire. Here were no gibers, censures, backbiters, pickpockets, highwaymen, housebreakers, attorneys, bawds, buffoons, gamesters, politicians, wits, splenetics, tedious talkers, controvertists, ravishers, murderers, robbers, virtuosos, no leaders or followers of party and faction, no encouragers to vice by seducement or examples, no dungeon, axes, gibbets, whipping posts or pillories, no cheating shopkeepers or mechanics, no pride, vanity or affection, no fops, bullies, drunkards, strolling whores or poxes, no ranting, lewd, expensive wives, no stupid, proud pedants, no importunate, overbearing, quarrelsome, noisy, roaring, empty, conceited, swearing companions, no scoundrels raised from the dust upon the merit of their vices, or nobility thrown into it on account of their virtues, no lords, fiddlers, judges, or dancing masters. I had the favor of being admitted to several Hohenems who came to visit or dine with my master, where his honor graciously suffered me to wait in the room and listen to their discourse. Both he and his company would often descend to ask me questions and receive my answers. I had also sometimes the honor of attending my master in his visits to others. I never presumed to speak except in answer to a question, and then I did it with inward regret, because it was a loss of so much time for improving myself. But I was infinitely delighted with the station of an humble auditor in such conversations, where nothing passed but what was useful expressed in the fewest and most significant words, where, as I have already said, the greatest decency was observed, without the least degree of ceremony, where no person spoke without being pleased himself and pleasing his companions, where there was no interruption, tediousness, heat, or difference of sentiments. They have a notion that when people are met together, a short silence doth much improve conversation. This I found to be true, for during those little intermissions of talk, new ideas would arise in their minds, which very much enlivened the discourse. Their subjects are generally on friendship and benevolence, on order and economy, sometimes upon the visible operations of nature or ancient traditions, upon the bounds and limits of virtue, upon the unerring rules of reason, or upon some determinations to be taken at the next great assembly, and often upon the various excellencies of poetry. I may add, without vanity, that my presence often gave them sufficient matter for discourse, because it offered my master an occasion of letting his friends into the history of me and my country, upon which they were all pleased to descant in a manner not very advantageous to humankind. And for that reason, I shall not repeat what they said, only I may be allowed to observe that his honor, to my great admiration, appeared to understand the nature of Yahoos much better than myself. He went through all our vices and follies, and discovered many which I had never mentioned to him, by only supposing what qualities a Yahoo of their country, with a small proportion of reason, might be capable of exerting, and concluded, with too much probability, how vile as well as miserable such a creature must be. I freely confess that all the little knowledge I have of any value was acquired by the lectures I received from my master and from hearing the discourses of him and his friends, to which I should be prouder to listen than to dictate to the greatest and wisest assembly in Europe. I admired the strength, comeliness, and speed of the inhabitants, and such a constellation of virtues in such admirable persons produced in me the highest veneration. At first, indeed, I did not feel that natural awe which the Yahoos and all other animals bear towards them, but it grew upon me by degrees, much sooner than I imagined, and was mingled with a respectful love and gratitude that they would condescend to distinguish me from the rest of my species. When I thought of my family, my friends, my countrymen, or human race in general, I considered them as they really were, Yahoos in shape and disposition, perhaps a little more civilized and qualified with the gift of speech, but making no other use of reason than to improve and multiply those vices whereof their brethren in this country had only the share that nature allotted them. When I happened to behold the reflection of my own form in a lake or fountain, I turned away my face in horror and detestation of myself, and could better endure the sight of a common Yahoo than of my own person. By conversing with the Hu'inam and looking upon them with delight, I fell to imitate their gait and gesture, which is now grown into a habit. And my friends often tell me, in a blunt way, that I trot like a horse, which, however, I take for a great compliment. Neither shall I disown that in speaking I am apt to fall into the voice and manner of the Hu'inam, and hear myself ridiculed on that account without the least mortification. In the midst of this happiness, when I looked upon myself to be fully settled for life, my master sent for me one morning a little earlier than his usual hour. I observed by his countenance that he was in some perplexity and at a loss how to begin what he had to speak. After a short silence, he told me he did not know how I would take what he was going to say, that in the last General Assembly, when the affair of the Yahoos was entered upon, the representatives had taken offense at his keeping a Yahoo, meaning myself, in his family more like a Hu'inam than a brute animal, that he was known frequently to converse with me as if he could receive some advantage or pleasure in my company, that such a practice was not agreeable to reason or nature or a thing ever heard of before among them. The assembly did therefore exhort him either to employ me like the rest of my species or command me to swim back to the place from whence I came. That the first of these expedients was utterly rejected by all the Hu'inam who had ever seen me at his house or their own, for they alleged that because I had some rudiments of reason added to the natural pravity of those animals, it was to be feared I might be able to seduce them into the woody and mountainous parts of the country and bring them in troops by night to destroy the Hu'inam cattle, as being naturally of the ravenous kind and averse from labor. My master added that he was daily pressed by the Hohenem of the neighborhood to have the assembly's exhortation executed, which he could not put off much longer. He doubted it would be impossible for me to swim to another country, and therefore wished I would contrive some sort of vehicle resembling those I had described to him that might carry me on the sea, in which work I should have the assistance of his own servants as well as those of his neighbors. He concluded that for his own part, he could have been content to keep me in his service as long as I lived, because he found I had cured myself of some bad habits and dispositions by endeavoring as far as my inferior nature was capable to imitate the Hohenems. I should here observe to the reader that a decree of the General Assembly in this country is expressed by the word Hunhoen, which signifies an exhortation, as near as I can render it, for they have no conception how a rational creature can be compelled, but only advised or exhorted, because no person can disobey reason without giving up his claim to be a rational creature. I was struck with the utmost grief and despair at my master's discourse, and being unable to support the agonies I was under, I fell into a swoon at his feet. When I came to myself, he told me that he concluded I had been dead, for these people are subject to no such imbecilities of nature. I answered, in a faint voice, that death would have been too great an happiness, that although I could not blame the assembly's exhortation or the urgency of his friends, yet in my weak and corrupt judgment I thought it might consist with reason to have been less rigorous, that I could not swim a league, and probably the nearest land to theirs might be distant about 100, that many materials necessary for making a small vessel to carry me off were wholly wanting in this country, which, however, I would attempt in obedience and gratitude to his honor, although I concluded the thing to be impossible, and therefore looked on myself as already devoted to destruction, that the certain prospect of an unnatural death was the least of my evils, for supposing I should escape with my life by some strange adventure, how could I think with temper of passing my days among yahoos and relapsing into my old corruptions for want of examples to lead and keep me within the paths of virtue? That I knew too well upon what solid reasons all the determinations of the wise Hohenem were founded, not to be shaken by arguments of mine, a miserable yahoo. And therefore, after presenting him with my humble thanks for the offer of his servant's assistance in making a vessel, and desiring a reasonable time for so difficult a work, I told him I would endeavor to preserve a wretched being, and if ever I returned to England, was not without hopes of being useful to my own species by celebrating the praises of the renowned Hohenem and proposing their virtues to the imitation of mankind. My master, in a few words, made me a very gracious reply, allowed me the space of 2 months to finish my boat, and ordered the sorrel nag, my fellow servant, for so at this distance I may presume to call him, to follow my instructions, because I told my master that his help would be sufficient, and I knew he had a tenderness for me. In his company, my first business was to go to that part of the coast where my rebellious crew had ordered me to be set on shore. I got upon a height, and looking on every side into the sea, fancied I saw a small island towards the northeast. I took out my pocket glass, and could then clearly distinguish it about 5 leagues off, as I computed. But it appeared to the sorrel nag to be only a blue cloud, for as he had no conception of any country beside his own, so he could not be as expert in distinguishing remote objects at sea as we who so much converse in that element. After I had discovered this island, I considered no further, but resolved it should, if possible, be the first place of my banishment, leaving the consequence to fortune. I returned home, and consulting with the sorrel nag, we went into a copse at some distance, where I with my knife, and he with a sharp flint fastened very artificially after their manner to a wooden handle, cut down several oak wattles, about the thickness of a walking staff, and some larger pieces. But I shall not trouble the reader with a particular description of my own mechanics. Let it suffice to say that in 6 weeks' time, with the help of the sorrel nag, who performed the parts that required most labor, I finished a sort of Indian canoe, but much larger, covering it with the skins of yahoos, well stitched together with hemp threads of my own making. My sail was likewise composed of the skins of the same animal, but I made use of the youngest I could get, the older being too tough and thick. And I likewise provided myself with 4 paddles. I laid in a stock of boiled flesh of rabbits and fowls, and took with me 2 vessels, one filled with milk and the other with water. I tried my canoe in a large pond near my master's house, and then corrected in it what was amiss, stopping all the chinks with Yahoo's tallow till I found it stanch and able to bear me and my freight. And when it was as complete as I could possibly make it, I had it drawn on a carriage very gently by Yahoo's to the seaside, under the conduct of the sorrel nag and another servant. When all was ready and the day came for my departure, I took leave of my master and lady and the whole family, mine eyes flowing with tears and my heart quite sunk with grief. But his honour, out of curiosity and perhaps, if I may speak it without vanity, partly out of kindness, was determined to see me in my canoe and got several of his neighbouring friends to accompany him. I was forced to wait above an hour for the tide, and then observing the wind very fortunately bearing towards the island to which I intended to steer my course, I took a second leave of my master, but as I was going to prostrate myself to kiss his hoof, he did me the honour to raise it gently to my mouth. I am not ignorant how much I have been censured for mentioning this last particular. Detractors are pleased to think it improbable that so illustrious a person should descend to give so great a mark of distinction to a creature so inferior as I. Neither have I forgot how apt some travellers are to boast of extraordinary favours they have received. But if these censures were better acquainted with the noble and courteous disposition of the Houyhnhnms, they would soon change their opinion. I paid my respects to the rest of the Houyhnhnms in his honour's company. Then getting into my canoe, I pushed off from shore.
So it was inevitable, wasn't it, that they were going to tell him he had to leave? He was acting too much like a Houyhnhnm, when he was nothing but a Yahoo. And the other Yahoos, you know, they were bound to get uppity. They had to get rid of him. And, of course, this kind of points out something about the Houyhnhnms and their naivete, as it were, that surely sending Gulliver back among the European Yahoos, of whom they've heard such horrible things, it's probably a little dangerous. Because if they could find Houyhnhnm land, they would come and they'd be doing so much more damage than the Yahoos who were already there. What with them having things like gunpowder and stuff like that. So it's hard to know if that was an oversight on Swift's part or if he just needed to move the narrative along. I kind of side with the need to move the narrative along part. I loved his list of horribly depraved people. Ending with dancing masters. Now, Asimov thinks that that was not actually a slight against dancing masters, but was instead a term of, you know, somebody who could step to either side of an argument and play both sides against the middle, some kind of toady. I don't know. I kind of think it's funny just to have Swift be so cantankerous that he is going after people who dance. He's just going to be ticked off at everybody. And I think we can probably also see the writing on the walls at this point, that if Gulliver has started falling into vocalizations and even movements and gestures that he is employing consciously or unconsciously in trying to fit in with the Houyhnhnm, and he is now leaving the Houyhnhnm, then he's going to encounter some difficulties coming back to human or Yahoo life. But the thing which I think probably shocked or should have shocked you was how Gulliver made his canoe, his building materials, right? Because what did he make his canoe out of? Yahoo skins. And what did he make the sails out of? Young Yahoo skins. I kind of doubt that, especially under the time constraints that he was experiencing, that he was able to find lots of young Yahoos who died of natural causes. Here he is so alienated from his own race, from his own people, from his own species, that he's taken to tanning the hide of children in order to make a sailing craft. It's really creepy. It's really creepy. And if you have already read A Modest Proposal, you see the resonance there. Swift is not one to shy away from that particular fight. He will go there and probably will continue to go there. Now, Gulliver Gulliver, in the next two chapters, he has to leave. We know that he is going to head towards Australia, and then he will, as usual, get picked up. Now, one of the things that I think is really important to note here, we have watched as his misfortunes have sent him to these places in the past. It started, as I've mentioned this before, with kind of natural problems. They were blown off course. Then it got a little harder and then a little more dangerous. And finally, when he came to Houyhnhnmland, there was the whole kerfuffle, and it was humans who caused the problems, the violence that sent him to Houyhnhnmland. So now, you know, we've worked our way up to human-on-human violence. So what are we going to expect to see from this next encounter? Because we know the rhythm of this book. We know there will be another encounter. Somehow, he's not going to make it back to England in his canoe. He's going to have to get there somewhere else, or somehow else. And so it's, I think it's important to note what Swift is saying, but it's also important to note how Gulliver reacts. All right, I'm going to break in one more time before the final chapter, but this is part 4, chapter 11. This is Gulliver's return home.
Chapter 11, The Author's Dangerous Voyage. He arrives at New Holland, hoping to settle there, is wounded with an arrow by one of the natives, is seized and carried by forces into a Portuguese ship, the great civilities of the captain. The author arrives at England. I began this desperate voyage on February 15th, 1714-15, at 9 o'clock in the morning. The wind was very favorable. However, I made use at first only of my paddles, but considering I should soon be weary and that the wind might probably chop about, I ventured to set up my little sail, and thus, with the help of the tide, I went at the rate of a league and a half an hour, as near as I could guess. My master and his friends continued on the shore till I was almost out of sight, and I often heard the sorrel nag, who always loved me, crying out, "Nya, nya, maya, yahoo! Take care of thyself, gentle yahoo." My design was, if possible, to discover some small island uninhabited, yet sufficient by my labor to furnish me with necessaries of life, which I would have thought a greater happiness than to be first minister in the politest court of Europe. So horrible was the idea I conceived of returning to live in the society and under the government of yahoos, for in such a solitude as I desired, I could at least enjoy my own thoughts and reflect with delight on the virtues of those inimitable Houyhnhnm, without any opportunity of degenerating into the vices and corruptions of my own species. The reader may remember what I related when my crew conspired against me and confined me to my cabin, how I continued there several weeks without knowing what course we took, and when I was put ashore in the longboat, how the sailors told me with oaths, whether true or false, that they knew not in what part of the world we were. However, I did then believe us to be about 10 degrees southward of the Cape of Good Hope, or about 45 degrees southern latitude, as I gathered from some general words I overheard among them, being, I supposed, to the southeast in their intended voyage to Madagascar. And although this were but little better than conjecture, yet I resolved to steer my course eastward, hoping to reach the southwest coast of New Holland, and perhaps some such island as I desired, lying westward of it. The wind was full west, and by 6 in the evening I computed I had gone eastward at least 18 leagues, when I spied a very small island about half a league off, which I soon reached. It was nothing but a rock with one creek, naturally arched by the force of tempests. Here I put in my canoe, and climbing a part of the rock, I could plainly discover land to the east, extending from south to north. I lay all night in my canoe, and repeating my voyage early in the morning, I arrived in 7 hours to the southeast point of New Holland. This confirmed me in the opinion I have long entertained, that the maps and charts place this country at least 3 degrees more to the east than it really is, which though I communicated many years ago to my worthy friend Mr. Herman Moll, and gave him my reasons for it, although he hath rather chosen to follow other authors. I saw no inhabitants in the place where I landed, and being unarmed, I was afraid of venturing far into the country. I found some shellfish on the shore and ate them raw, not daring to kindle a fire for fear of being discovered by the natives. I continued 3 days feeding on oysters and limpets to save my own provisions, and I fortunately found a brook of excellent water, which gave me great relief. On the 4th day, venturing out early a little too far, I saw 20 or 30 natives upon a height not above 500 yards from me. They were stark naked, men, women, and children, round a fire, as I could discover by the smoke. One of them spied me, and gave notice to the rest. 5 of them advanced towards me, leaving the women and children at the fire. I made what haste I could to the shore, and getting into my canoe, shoved off. The savages, observing me retreat, ran after me, and before I could get far enough into the sea, discharged an arrow, which wounded me deeply on the inside of my left knee. I shall carry the mark to my grave. I apprehended the arrow might be poisoned, and paddling out of the reach of their darts, being a calm day, I made a shift to suck the wound and dress it as well as I could. I was at a loss what to do, for I durst not return to the same landing place, but stood to the north and was forced to paddle, for the wind, although very gentle, was against me, blowing northwest. As I was looking about for a secure landing place, I saw a sail to the north-northeast, which appearing every minute more visible, I was in some doubt whether I should wait for them or no. But at last my detestation of the Yahoo race prevailed, and turning my canoe, I sailed and paddled together to the south, and got into the same creek from whence I set out in the morning, choosing rather to trust myself among these barbarians than live with European Yahoos. I drew up my canoe as close as I could to the shore, and hid myself behind a stone by the little brook, which, as I have already said, was excellent water. The ship came within half a league of this creek, and sent out her longboat with vessels to take in fresh water, for the place, it seems, was very well known, but I did not observe it until the boat was almost on shore, and it was too late to seek another hiding place. The seamen at their landing observed my canoe, and rummaging it all over, easily conjectured that the owner could not be far off. 4 of them, well armed, searched every cranny and lurking hole, till at last they found me flat on my face behind the stone. They gazed a while in admiration at my strange, uncouth dress, my coat made of skins, my wooden-soled shoes, and my furred stockings, from whence, however, they concluded I was not a native of the place, who all go naked. One of the seamen in Portuguese bid me rise and asked who I was. I understood that language very well, and getting upon my feet, said I was a poor Yahoo banished from the Houenum, and desired they would please to let me depart. They admired to hear me answer them in their own tongue, and saw by my complexion I must be an European, but were at a loss to know what I meant by Yahoos and Houenums, and at the same time fell a-laughing at my strange tone in speaking, which resembled the neighing of a horse. I trembled all the while, betwixt fear and hatred. I again desired leave to depart, and was gently moving to my canoe. But they laid hold on me, desiring to know what country I was of, whence I came, with many other questions. I told them I was born in England, from whence I came about 5 years ago, and then their country and ours were at peace. I therefore hoped they would not treat me as an enemy, since I meant them no harm, but was a poor Yahoo seeking some desolate place where to pass the remainder of his unfortunate life. When they began to talk, I thought I never heard or saw anything so unnatural, for it appeared to me as monstrous as if a dog or cow should speak in England or a Yahoo in Houenum land. The honest Portuguese were equally amazed at my strange dress and the odd manner of delivering my words, which, however, they understood very well. They spoke to me with great humanity, and said they were sure their captain would carry me gratis to Lisbon, from whence I might return to my own country, that 2 of the seamen would go back to the ship to inform the captain of what they had seen and receive his orders. In the meantime, unless I would give my solemn oath not to fly, they would secure me by force. I thought it best to comply with their proposal. They were very curious to know my story, but I gave them very little satisfaction, and they all conjectured that my misfortunes had impaired my reason. In 2 hours the boat, which went loaded with vessels of water, returned with the captain's commands to fetch me on board. I fell on my knees to preserve my liberty, but all was in vain, and the men, having tied me with cords, heaved me into the boat, from whence I was taken into the ship, and from thence into the captain's cabin. His name was Pedro de Mendez. He was a very courteous and generous person. He entreated me to give some account of myself, and desired to know what I would eat or drink, said I should be used as well as himself, and spoke so many obliging things that I wondered to find such civilities from a Yahoo. However, I remained silent and sullen. I was ready to faint at the very smell of him and his men. At last, I desired something to eat out of my canoe, but he ordered me a chicken and some excellent wine, and then directed that I should be put to bed in a very clean cabin. I would not undress myself, but lay on the bedclothes, and in half an hour stole out when I thought the crew was at dinner, and getting to the side of the ship was going to leap into the sea and swim for my life rather than continue among Yahoos. But one of the seamen prevented me, and having informed the captain, I was chained to my cabin. After dinner, Don Pedro came to me, and desired to know my reason for so desperate an attempt, assured me he only meant to do me all the services he was able, and spoke so very movingly that at last I descended to treat him like an animal which had some little portion of reason. I gave him a very short relation of my voyage, of the conspiracy against me by my own men, of the country where they set me on shore, and of my 5 years' residence there, all which he looked upon as if it were a dream or a vision, whereat I took great offense, for I had quite forgot the faculty of lying, so peculiar to Yahoos and all countries where they preside, and consequently the disposition of suspecting truth in others of their own species. I asked him whether it were the custom of his country to say the thing that was not. I assured him I had almost forgot what he meant by falsehood, and if I had lived 1,000 years in Houyhnhnm land, I should never have heard a lie from the meanest servant, that I was altogether indifferent whether he believed me or no. But, however, in return for his favors, I would give him so much allowance to the corruption of his nature as to answer any objection he would please to make, and he might easily discover the truth. The captain, a wise man, after many endeavors to catch me tripping in some part of my story, at last began to have a better opinion of my veracity. But he added that since I professed so enviable an attachment to truth, I must give him my word of honor to bear him company in this voyage without attempting anything against my life, or else he would continue me a prisoner till we arrived at Lisbon. I gave him the promise he required, but at the same time protested that I would suffer the greatest hardships rather than return to live among Yahoos. Our voyage passed without any considerable accident. In gratitude to the captain, I sometimes sat with him at his earnest request, and strove to conceal my antipathy against humankind, although it often broke out, which he suffered to pass without observation. But the greatest part of the day I confined myself to my cabin to avoid seeing any of the crew. The captain had often entreated me to strip myself of my savage dress, and offered to lend me the best suit of clothes he had. This I would not be prevailed on to accept, abhorring to cover myself with anything that had been on the back of a Yahoo. I only desired he would lend me 2 clean shirts, which, having been washed since he wore them, I believed would not so much defile me. These I changed every second day, and washed them myself. We arrived at Lisbon, November 5th, 1715. At our landing, the captain forced me to cover myself with his cloak to prevent the rabble from crowding about me. I was conveyed to his own house, and at my earnest request, he led me up to the highest room backwards. I conjured him to conceal from all persons what I had told him of the Houyhnhnms, because the least hint of a story would not only draw numbers of people to see me, but probably put me in danger of being imprisoned or burnt by the Inquisition. The captain persuaded me to accept a suit of clothes newly made, but I would not suffer the tailor to take my measure. However, Don Pedro being almost of my size, they fit me well enough. He accoutred me with other necessaries all new, which I aired for about 24 hours before I would use them. The captain had no wife, nor above 3 servants, none of which were suffered to attend at meals, and his whole deportment was so obliging, added to very good human understanding, that I really began to tolerate his company. He gained so far upon me that I ventured to look out of the back window. By degrees I was brought into another room, from whence I peeped into the street, but drew my head back in a fright. In a week's time, he seduced me down to the door. I found my terror gradually lessened, but my hatred and contempt seemed to increase. I was at last bold enough to walk in the street in his company, but kept my nose well stopped with rue or sometimes with tobacco. In 10 days, Don Pedro, to whom I had given some account of my domestic affairs, put it upon me as a point of honor and conscience that I ought to return to my native country and live at home with my wife and children. He told me there was an English ship in the port, just ready to sail, and he would furnish me with all things necessary. It would be tedious to repeat his arguments and my contradictions. He said it was altogether impossible to find such a solitary island as I had desired to live in, but I might command in my own house, and pass my time in a manner as recluse as I pleased. I complied at last, finding I could not do better. I left Lisbon the 24th day of November, in an English merchantman, but who was the master I never inquired. Don Pedro accompanied me to the ship, and lent me £20. He took kind leave of me, and embraced me at parting, which I bore as well as I could. During this last voyage, I had no commerce with the master or any of his crew, but pretending I was sick, kept close in my cabin. On the 5th of December, 1715, we cast anchor in the Downs about 9 in the morning, and at 3 in the afternoon, I got safe to my house at Redriff. My wife and family received me with great surprise and joy, because they concluded me certainly dead. But I must freely confess, the sight of them filled me only with hatred, disgust, and contempt, and the more by reflecting on the near alliance I had to them. For, although since my unfortunate exile from the Houyhnhnm country, I had compelled myself to tolerate the sight of Yahoos and to converse with Don Pedro de Menes, yet my memory and imaginations were perpetually filled with the virtues and ideas of those excellent Houyhnhnms. And when I began to consider that by copulating with one of the Yahoo species, I had become a parent of more, it struck me with the utmost shame, confusion, and horror. As soon as I entered the house, my wife took me in her arms and kissed me, at which, having not been used to the touch of that odious animal for so many years, I fell in a swoon for almost an hour. At the time I am writing, it is 5 years since my last return to England. During the first year, I could not endure my wife or children in my presence. The very smell of them was intolerable. Much less could I suffer them to eat in the same room. To this hour, they dare not presume to touch my bread or drink out of the same cup. Neither was I ever able to let one of them take me by the hand. The first money I laid out was to buy 2 young stone horses, which I keep in a good stable, and next to them, the groom is my greatest favorite, for I feel my spirits revived by the smell he contracts in the stable. My horses understand me tolerably well. I converse with them at least 4 hours every day. They are strangers to bridle or saddle. They live in great amity with me and friendship to each other.
So in case the term stone horses is as unfamiliar to you as it was to me, it means they still have their stones. These are not horses that have been castrated. They are stallions. And there they are. In the stable, hanging with Gulliver. So our guy, our sweet guy, our gullible Gulliver, who started off on all these adventures, you know, with a pure heart and just kind of reporting back what he's seen to us, he's now only happy talking to horses. And probably not even bright horses. He says that they're conversing, but it's hard to know how much the horses really understand him. And in this chapter, Swift's not going to give us any help on that. Now, I find the next chapter, the final chapter of the book, to be fascinating, because he could end the book here. Gulliver's home. He's not himself. He is still fighting against his Yahoo nature, and he's more comfortable with horses than he is with humans. Fine, you could stop there. But Swift started this book like a travel book. The you know, I went on a tormented journey. I was treated so badly by natives. I survived by the help of God. And he's going to have to go back to that. You know, this book is, in fact, a fairly traditional structure in that it is bookended by this false constraint, this created reality that Swift is maintained throughout the book. And now we can see that the process of trying to be a perfectly rational being has pretty much driven Gulliver crazy. So we can't be like the Lilliputians. We can't be like the Brobdingnagians. We can't be like any of the people we met in the Laputa chapter. And we also can't be purely rational. All we can be is a mess. There's no safe ground for us to stand on. Including Swift's. I mean, he's drawn himself into a corner. There's nowhere for him to go. And there's nowhere for us to go either. So, he has a final chapter to write. And he includes in it, not right at the beginning, which is interesting, but a couple paragraphs in, he includes a Latin phrase from Virgil, from the Aeneid. So the Aeneid is the story of the Trojan War, and well, it's the story of Aeneas, but it included in there is the story of the Trojan War. And evidently there is a character named Sinon, S-I-N-O-N, who, I didn't remember this. He's a storyteller, and I'm putting air quotes around the word story, and he has the great good fortune to be the one who explains to the Trojans that he was badly mistreated by the Greeks. So he's allowed himself to be captured. He's Greek. He's badly mistreated by the Greeks, and the wooden horse is really an offering to Athena, and that it'll protect Troy, and you know, you need to bring it into your city, bring Athena into your city. And you know the story, the Trojans fall for it, and the warriors pop out at night and kill everyone. So Sinon is this huge liar and a traitorous liar too. He's really bald-faced in what he perpetrates on the Trojans after a very long war. And the line which Aaron reads in the Latin, I will translate for you here, is, though fortune, capital fortune, personified fortune, has made Sinon wretched, she has not made him untrue or a liar. So just because he's kind of pathetic doesn't mean he's also a liar. And of course, the reality is he's a big, fat, honking liar is what he is. And Gulliver's quoting this passage to you. Swift is letting Gulliver quote this passage to you as a way to prove, in quotation marks, that his narrative is true. This whole last chapter is just there to remind you that this was all a satire. And oh my gosh, golly, look, everything I've told you is true. And isn't it miraculous that I've been able to come back unscathed? And isn't it wonderful, all of these true things? And how I never had to descend to talking about politics or party politics or anything like that, when of course, you know, 2/3 of the book was ripping into the Whigs. Now, there are some archaic moments in this chapter, too, that I want to make sure I give you. He talks about naked Americans. He's talking about the Aztecs in Mexico. And I think he probably has less to say here about whether they were wearing any clothes than that they were naked when it came to defending themselves. They were going up against Europeans who had gunpowder and horses. So as far as defense goes, they were naked for the most part. He talks about mummy, which means kind of a pulp, and yerks, which is another word for kicks. He also has a Latin quote about Caesar Augustus, and that quote, which is shorter, recalcitrat undique tutus, is he kicks backward, protected on each side. Because, of course, Augustus was Julius Caesar's grand-nephew, I think, and so it's he's protected by being a relative of Julius Caesar's, along with being a pretty decent strategian and warrior. And the last little bit is the word intellectuals. He will use that, and what he really means is brains, intellectuality, or his, you know, someone's brains, and that's it. So let's have a go at the end.
Chapter 12. The Author's Veracity. his design in publishing this work, his censure of those travelers who swerve from the truth. The author clears himself from any sinister ends in writing. An objection answered. The method of planning colonies. His native country commended. The right of the crown to those countries described by the author is justified. The difficulty of conquering them. The author takes his last leave of the reader, proposeth his manner of living for the future, gives good advice, and concludeth. Thus, gentle reader, I have given thee a faithful history of my travels for 6 years and above 7 months, wherein I have not been so studious of ornament as of truth. I could perhaps, like others, have astonished thee with strange, improbable tales, but I rather chose to relate plain matter of fact in the simplest manner and style, because my principal design was to inform and not to amuse thee. It is easy for us who travel into remote countries, which are seldom visited by Englishmen or other Europeans, to form descriptions of wonderful animals both at sea and land, whereas a traveler's chief aim should be to make men wiser and better, and to improve their minds by the bad as well as good example of what they deliver concerning foreign parts. I could heartily wish a law were enacted that every traveler, before he were permitted to publish his voyages, should be obliged to make an oath before the Lord High Chancellor that all he intended to print was absolutely true to the best of his knowledge. For then the world would no longer be deceived as it usually is, while some writers, to make their work pass the better upon the public, impose the grossest fallacies on the unwary reader. I have perused several books of travels with great delight in my younger days, but having since gone over most parts of the globe, and been able to contradict many fabulous accounts from my own observation, it hath given me a great disgust against this part of reading, and some indignation to see the credulity of mankind so impudently abused. Therefore, since my acquaintance were pleased to think my poor endeavours might not be unacceptable to my country, I imposed on myself as a maxim never to be swerved from, that I would strictly adhere to truth. Neither, indeed, can I be ever under the least temptation to vary from it, while I retain in my mind the lectures and examples of my noble master and the other illustrious Hoenum, of whom I had so long the honour to be an humble hearer. Nec si miserum fortuna sinonem fingset vanunum, etiam mendequemque improba finget. I know very well how little reputation is to be got by writings which require neither genius nor learning, nor indeed any other talent, except a good memory or an excellent journal. I know likewise that writers of travels, like dictionary makers, are sunk into oblivion by the weight and bulk of those who come last and therefore lie uppermost. And it is highly probable that such travelers who shall hereafter visit the countries described in this work of mine may, by detecting my errors, if there be any, and adding many new discoveries of their own, jostle me out of vogue and stand in my place, making the world forget that ever I was an author. This indeed would be too great a mortification if I wrote for fame, but as my sole intention was the public good, I cannot be altogether disappointed. For who can read of the virtues I have mentioned in the glorious Hoenum without being ashamed of his own vices when he considers himself as the reasoning governing animal of his country? I shall say nothing of those remote nations where Yahoos preside, among which the least corrupted are the Brobdingnagians, whose wise maxims in morality and government it would be our happiness to observe. But I forbear descanting further, and rather leave the judicious reader to his own remarks and applications. I am not a little pleased that this work of mine can possibly meet with no censures. For what objections can be made against a writer who relates only plain facts that happen in such distant countries where we have not the least interest with respect either to trade or negotiations? I have carefully avoided every fault with which common writers of travels are often too justly charged. Besides, I meddle not the least with any party, but write without passion, prejudice, or ill will against any man or number of men whatsoever. I write for the noblest end, to inform and instruct mankind, over whom I may, without breach of modesty, pretend to some superiority, for the advantages I received by conversing so long among the most accomplished Hoenums. I write without any view towards profit or praise. I never suffer a word to pass that may look like reflection or possibly give the least offense even to those who are most ready to take it, so that I hope I may with justice pronounce myself an author perfectly blameless, against whom the tribes of answerers, considerers, observers, reflectors, detectors, remarkers will never be able to find matter for exercising their talents. I confess it was whispered to me that I was bound in duty as a subject of England to have given in a memorial to a Secretary of State at my first coming over, because whatever lands are discovered by a subject belong to the Crown. But I doubt whether our conquests in the countries I treat of would be as easy as those of Ferdinando Cortez over the naked Americans. The Lilliputians, I think, are hardly worth the charge of a fleet and army to reduce them, and I question whether it might be prudent or safe to attempt the Brobdingnagians, or whether an English army would be much at their ease with the flying island over their heads. The Houyhnhnms, indeed, appear not to be so well prepared for war, a science to which they are perfect strangers, and especially against missive weapons. However, supposing myself to be a minister of state, I could never give my advice for invading them. Their prudence, unanimity, unacquaintedness with fear, and their love of their country would amply supply all defects in the military art. Imagine 20,000 of them breaking into the midst of an European army, confounding the ranks, overturning the carriages, battering the warriors' faces into mummy by terrible yerks from their hinder hooves. For they would well deserve the character given to Augustus, recalcitrate undiquitatus. But instead of proposals for conquering that magnanimous nation, I rather wish they were in a capacity or disposition to send a sufficient number of their inhabitants for civilizing Europe, by teaching us the first principles of honor, justice, truth, temperance, public spirit, fortitude, chastity, friendship, benevolence, and fidelity, the names of which virtues are still retained among us in most languages, and are to be met with in modern as well as ancient authors, which I am able to assert from my own small reading. But I had another reason which made me less forward to enlarge His Majesty's dominions by my discoveries. To say the truth, I had conceived a few scruples with relation to the distributive justice of princes upon those occasions. For instance, a crew of pirates are driven by a storm they know not whither. At length a boy discovers land from the topmast. They go on shore to rob and plunder. They see an harmless people, are entertained with kindness. They give the country a new name. They take formal possession of it for the king. They set up a rotten plank or a stone for a memorial. They murder 2 or 3 dozen of the natives, bring away a couple more by force for a sample, return home, and get their pardon. Here commences a new dominion acquired with a title by divine right. Ships are sent with the first opportunity, the natives driven out or destroyed, their princes tortured to discover their gold, a free license given to all acts of inhumanity and lust, the earth reeking with the blood of its inhabitants, and this execrable crew of butchers employed in so pious an expedition is a modern colony sent to convert and civilize an idolatrous and barbarous people. But this description, I confess, doth by no means affect the British nation, who may be an example to the world for their wisdom, care, and justice in planting colonies, their liberal endowments for the advancement of religion and learning, their choice of devout and able pastors to propagate Christianity, their caution in stocking their provinces with people of sober lives and conversations from this mother kingdom, their strict regard to the distribution of justice in supplying the civil administration through all their colonies with officers of the greatest abilities, utter strangers to corruption, and to crown all by sending the most vigilant and virtuous governors who have no other views than the happiness of their people over whom they preside and the honor of the king their master. But as those countries which I have described do not appear to have a desire of being conquered and enslaved, murdered, or driven out by colonies, nor abound either in gold, silver, sugar, or tobacco, I did humbly conceive they were by no means proper objects of our zeal, our valor, or our interest. However, if those whom it may concern think fit to be of another opinion, I am ready to depose when I shall be lawfully called, that no European did ever visit these countries before me. I mean, if the inhabitants ought to be believed. But as to the formality of taking possession in my sovereign's name, it never came once into my thoughts. And if it had, yet as my affairs then stood, I should perhaps, in point of prudence and self-preservation, have put it off to a better opportunity. Having thus answered the only objection that can be raised against me as a traveller, I here take a final leave of my courteous readers and return to enjoy my own speculations in my little garden at Redriff, to apply those excellent lessons of virtue which I learned among the Houyhnhnms, to instruct the Yahoos of my own family as far as I shall find them docile animals, to behold my figure often in a glass, and thus, if possible, habituate myself by time to tolerate the sight of a human creature, to lament the brutality of Houyhnhnms in my own country, but always treat their persons with respect for the sake of my noble master, his family, his friends, and the whole Houyhnhnm race, whom these of ours have the honour to resemble in all their lineaments, however their intellectuals came to degenerate. I began last week to permit my wife to sit at dinner with me, at the farthest end of a long table, and to answer, but with the utmost brevity, the few questions I asked her. Yet the smell of a Yahoo continuing very offensive, I always keep my nose well stopped with rue, lavender, or tobacco. And although it be hard for a man late in life to remove old habits, I am not altogether out of hopes in some time to suffer a neighbor Yahoo in my company without the apprehensions I am yet under of his teeth or his claws. My reconcilement to the Yahoo kind in general might not be so difficult if they would be content with those vices and follies only which nature hath entitled them to. I am not in the least provoked at the sight of a lawyer, a pickpocket, a colonel, a fool, a lord, a gamester, a politician, a whoremonger, a physician, an evidence, a suborner, an attorney, a traitor, or the like. This is all according to the due course of things. But when I behold a lump of deformity and diseases, both in body and mind, smitten with pride, it immediately breaks all the measure of my patience. Neither shall I be ever able to comprehend how such an animal and such a vice could tally together. The wise and virtuous Houyhnhnms, who abound in all excellencies that can adorn a rational creature, have no name for this vice in their language, which hath no terms to express anything that is evil, except those whereby they describe the detestable qualities of their Yahoos, among which they were not able to distinguish this of pride, for want of thorough understanding human nature, as it showeth itself in other countries where the animal presides. But I, who had more experience, could plainly observe some rudiments of it among the wild Yahoos. But the Houyhnhnms, who live under the government of reason, are no more proud of the good qualities they possess than I should be for not wanting a leg or an arm, which no man in his wits would boast of, although he must be miserable without them. I dwell the longer upon this subject, from the desire I have to make the society of an English Yahoo by any means not insupportable. And therefore, I here entreat those who have any tincture of this absurd vice, that they will not presume to appear in my sight. Finis.
So there he is, at the end, Swift, finally lashing out at pride. Because it's pride, in some sense, that made Gulliver so appalled by the Yahoos on the island that he couldn't stand the thought of himself being like them, this vulgar, hairy, gross race. And therefore it was that pride that drove him mad trying to become a Houyhnhnm, which he couldn't do no matter what. And it wasn't tenable. He couldn't stand there. Now, the final paragraph, the last thing that Aaron read to you, is really convoluted. And so I've tried to parse it in just normal speech. And what he's trying to say at the end, or what he said, but what we would have a hard time understanding, is horses aren't proud of their brains any more than I am for having two arms and two legs. Although, obviously, if you were missing your arms or legs, or missing your brains, you would be kind of unhappy about it. Then he goes on to say, I'm focusing on all this stuff. I'm talking about all of this because I have to live here. And therefore, I beg any of you who have even a little pride to stay away from me. The end. Yeah, kind of brutal satire. And of course, he didn't really have to work very hard to criticize colonization or what happened in the Americas or anything like that. I do think it's interesting, though, in our 21st century, having gone through kind of the 60s and the pushback against colonialism and the anti-apartheid movement and all of that. You know, when that pushback was happening in the last part of the 20th century, it seemed like this was news to everyone. Like, wow, you mean colonialism is bad? And then you read White Man's Burden, you go, no, see, Kipling got it. And then you go and you read Conrad's Heart of Darkness, and you notice that everything white in the book is evil. Conrad saw it. So it shouldn't be such a surprise to us that Swift has such a keen eye and ear for what's been going on in the name of the crown, and allows himself to say, yeah, I didn't really feel comfortable about claiming these lands for the crown. But then he gives other reasons. It's, you know, he keeps himself safe, or keeps Gulliver safe, and by proxy, himself. So there it is, the end of Gulliver's Travels. Now, what does this mean for you, for Craftlit, for Just the Books, for all of this? What it means is I'm going to take a little bit of a break while I prepare for Jane Eyre. Jane Eyre is still happening, and that is going to start on October 26th. We're going to have some fun stuff leading up to that date. That week is our D week instead of D day. And all of the subscriber incentives are still going to be continuing. Cool for Cats will still continue. Wuthering Heights will still continue. And, oh gosh, maybe I should do Heart of Darkness after Wuthering Heights. That's a book we should do. So that's it for me. I hope you've enjoyed Gulliver's Travels. It's such a modern book in so many ways, and it just broke my heart that nobody was reading it anymore. So I really appreciate you sticking with me and getting through to the end, because it's important. And speaking of important, Julie just sent me, actually that's not true, Julie sent me a few days ago, but I just saw a link to a TED Talk. It's only a 20-minute TED Talk, and it's marvelous. And I think it actually sums up why all of you are better. I think there's some important information in there. And I really do think it describes all of the Craftlit listeners who I've ever had a chance to meet in person. So go take a look. 20 minutes out of your life. It's not going to hurt you. So have a great couple of weeks. I will be back on the 26th with Jane Eyre. And I look forward to talking to you then. Have a great one. Talk to you soon. Bye. There are many ways to listen to Craftlit. You can listen on your smartphone via the Stitcher Radio app. You can subscribe free through iTunes, or you can download and listen to the iPhone, iTouch, and Android app, where you'll receive occasional extras for the show. Craftlit is supported in a number of ways. Knit Circus, the free e-newsletter featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at knitcircus.com. Also, the What Would Madame Defarge Knit series, Volume 2, What Else Would Madame Defarge Knit, is now in pre-orders. You can find out more from the links in the show notes at craftlit.com. Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories from the heart and home. And Seedpod Publishing, a micro-publisher cooperative publishing books not for their value as products, but for their value. Any questions? Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.